Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Marcus Roberts from YouGov. Now last night YouGov published its latest and last MRP of the election and it forecasts that the Tories are on course for a smaller majority than previously predicted of 28. So the Conservatives, if an election were held tomorrow, which it is going to be, YouGov forecasts that the Conservatives would win 339 seats, with Labour on 231, the Lib Dems on 15 and the SNP on 41. Marcus, why has the Tory majority got so small?
Because when we first discussed the MRP a couple of weeks ago in terms of its findings, back when it was showing a very comfortable Conservative majority of 68, one of the things I warned about was how that majority was wide but fragile, big but shallow. And that was because it was made up of a great many Conservative constituency majorities that were measured in the hundreds of votes rather than the thousands of votes. As a consequence, a relatively small change in the national vote share can have a disproportionate effect upon the majorities in those seats and flip a number of them, particularly when what is happening in terms of tactical voting actually seems to be happening to a greater extent than many people expected in this election, certainly far greater than CCHQ hoped for. What that means is that even with a relatively small change in the national vote share, the optimization of that anti-conservative vote in the marginals that matter to the advantage of the SNP in Scotland, to a little bit of the advantage of the Liberal Democrats in the south, and to Labour's advantage in its northern heartlands has all conspired to mean that even though the national vote share projected between the two different YouGov models has only changed by 2 points, from an 11-point lead to roughly a 9-point lead, we've seen the Conservative majority fall from 68 to 28.
James, you've been saying throughout this campaign that the Conservatives have been hoping for a poll that would panic voters at the last minute. So this is good news, right?
I don't think the Tories are that despondent about these numbers, in that one of their, you know, it's no coincidence that a Tory memo appeared on the front page of Daily Telegraph the other day saying, we are very close to hung parliament territory, this election is not a done deal, etc., etc., etc. I think the Tories would like this to be a rogue poll rather than the most respected polling model out there. But, you know, I think that they will hope that this drives home the message that, you know, if you want Brexit done, you've got to vote for it. And someone close to Boris Johnson said to me the other day, you've got to hope that the kind of national hive mind decides that the country doesn't want to spend next year talking about Brexit even more than we have this year, and that ultimately tips the balance in their favour. But as Marcus said, these numbers are very tight. I think one of the differences, and this is a statement of the obvious in many ways, but when you looked at that previous 68 majority, there were lots of seats when your draw hit the floor that the Tories were winning them. When you look through the list on this 28 majority, partly it's because the idea of Bolsover going Tory has become slightly normalised, but it is less surprising. You know, for example, you know, Putney goes Labour, something that, you know, people would have expected at the beginning of a campaign. Lee stays Labour, just, you know, all of those kind of things. So I think there is that element. I think the Tory worry will be that Labour are doing better in this kind of fine, as you got, you know, the MRP takes data over a week, I think I'm right in saying, and that basically Labour's best bits are the most recent. And the worry for the Tories will be that that trend continues. They will hope that, you know, some combination of their closing message of get Brexit done and this poll kind of can slightly arrest that. They don't want this. They don't want the issue on voters' minds on Thursday as they walk to the polling station to be the NHS. They want it to be Brexit.
Now, Marcus, how big a deal has Boris Johnson's behaviour, his reactions to certain big news stories, including the photo of a boy on the floor of a hospital emergency department, how big a part has that played in this reduced predicted majority?
I think at the emotional level, it is likely to have played a role, not least of all because our polling shows a decided shift away from the Conservatives amongst some of their Labour defectors in the North that they had been gaining previously, and also a concern more generally around Conservatives on the NHS issue. And this matters because of the reassurance mission that Boris Johnson had in this general election. He had to reassure Labour Northern voters that he was going to be safe and trustworthy. And what he did with that moment of seeming heartlessness was he demonstrated to their worst fears about him rather than their best hopes for him. This could be, to some extent, a simple chronological correlation. It could be that it happened at the same time as the swing against the Conservatives happened. But what we do know is that the swing was getting worse for the Conservatives as time was going on in the last few days of running the MRP. And we do know that the Conservatives were having a rough time, particularly as a result of Boris Johnson and that photo with that poor boy and his family. So I think that it was a totally unforced error by the Prime Minister that might have created a moment that even low information voters tuned into, and particularly at a time in which the Conservatives needed to reassure these voters that it was okay to vote Labour. And Fraser and you all were discussing on Friday's podcast how difficult, how very difficult it is culturally for many Northern voters to go across to the Conservatives. And this was the worst possible reminder at the worst possible time of the cultural problem that many people have still in this country of voting for what they see as toxic Tories.
James, is there anything the Tories can do in the next, 36 hours to recover that, to suddenly convince those Labour voters that they have the values that are going to make them cross over?
I don't think they can do... I mean, I think what is remarkable in a way is it was another former Spectator editor, Nigel Lawson, who said that the NHS is the closest that this country has to a national religion. And Boris Johnson's campaign, rather than attempting to any kind of reformation of it, is trying to present himself as a high priest of it. He just talks about building more hospitals, pumping more money into it. You know, I don't think we've ever heard a sentence from him in this campaign about reform or change to the NHS. He's just trying to say, look, you know, here are the goods I'm putting, the money I'm putting in on the altar of the NHS. And so I don't think they can do that much more. I think their best chance is to emphasise the Brexit message and the ending the gridlock message. I think the point about get Brexit done is it's a slogan that works two ways. To leavers, it's like, we're finally going to get what we voted for. To people who are just fed up with this, which I think is a large and growing chunk of the country, it's a suggestion that the country can move on and start dealing with other domestic issues. I mean, I think the kind of question now becomes as well, you know, how much does Jeremy Corbyn become an issue in the final days of a campaign? I think one of the things that has hurt the Tories is that the more sense there was that Labour were not going to win, the less Corbyn has been an issue in this campaign. And I think the kind of question is whether in these last, whatever we are, 48 hours or so, whether the Corbyn factor comes to the fore again. You know, you have an advert from a whole bunch of ex-Labour MPs going out in regional papers in the North today saying, you know, don't vote for Labour. This isn't the Labour Party that you used to vote for. And I think whether that Corbyn factor cuts through at the last is going to determine whether a lot of these Northern seats that are, cliche alert, on a knife edge, which way they fall.
Marcus, let's talk about some of these Northern seats that are on a knife edge. What are the particularly interesting ones? Some of them have switched back to potentially being Labour, for instance, Workington being the emblematic seat of this campaign. Workington Man seems to be more attracted to Labour again.
Yeah, I think that it's really important to understand that the MRP of last night was a now cast rather than a forecast. And what I mean by that is, if the election had been tomorrow, that's what we think had been yesterday, that's what we think would have happened yesterday. We don't know whether or not this is an object still in motion. We don't know whether or not that this is continuing on a trajectory towards a hung parliament, or whether there will be something that arrests that decline in the Conservative position. because there's such a thing as observer reactions. There's such a thing as the way in which the publication of this MRP and the awareness of how much closer this election now appears to be then changes how people respond to that reality. And that definitely plays out in seats and definitely plays out in interesting seats. Some of the places I'd particularly look at would be Ochil and South Perthshire, where the SNP might gain a seat on an increase of just 160 votes. I'd look at Aberconway, I'd look at Aberdeen South, I'd look at Moray. Why I'd be looking at those seats is because those are some of the places that change hands if there's just a 1-point national shift away from the Conservatives. Now think of that as roughly equivalent to about 500 votes in a marginal seat. What that does, if we presume that this is that first scenario in which the Conservative trajectory is continuing downwards, what that does is reduce the Conservative majority by about 3 to an overall majority of 22. If we continue that into a 2-point reduction in the Conservative lead, that takes us down further a handful of seats to a Conservative majority of roughly 16. This is important because, as James was saying, when you look at the list of the seats that the Conservatives are holding or failing to gain, as it were, we've already baked into the cake some of those Putneys and some of those Winchesters. And there is a chance that the Conservatives can win some of them back because of what I'm saying about how different people react to this. There are 3 scenarios I think that's important to consider here. 1, snowballing, that this encourages the Labour vote. This encourages further tactical voting towards the SNP and the Liberal Democrats in those places where that matters. And that, as a result, leads to a further diminution of the Conservative majority, even towards a hung parliament. Scenario 2, it might mean, as James says, that this now wakes voters up to the very real prospect of Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. As a consequence, say you're a Liberal Democrat, Conservative waverer in Winchester, and you thought up until yesterday that it was completely fine for you to vote Liberal Democrat in Winchester and still wake up with Brexit happening and Boris Johnson number 10. This might wake you up and make you think, I can't risk Jeremy Corbyn. Or there's the third scenario, and that is both of those things happen, and they effectively neutralise one another. In that scenario, we imagine that that anti-conservative tactical voting continues, and at the same time, there is a counter-reaction to how close an election this is, leading up to a shoring of the Conservative vote in some places, as well as an improvement of the Labour vote in other places at the same time. In that case, the Conservatives would probably be looking to achieve a majority still in the 20s, as opposed to in the teens or even in single figures.
I think one thing which makes the Tories nervous, though, is the respective ground games, and particularly where the Tories need to make gains. You take Bolsover, right? There is a Tory lead there. But it's according to the YouGov MRP, it is a 2-point lead. Who do you think has a more established network in Bolsover in terms of getting people to the polls on polling day? Labour or the Tories? No prizes for guessing. And I think the challenge is, how much of that in these very tight races can the Tories absorb that kind of differential, who's got the people in place to give people a lift to the polling station, all that kind of jazz.
How much can they deploy paid campaigners? Because they have done that.
You can do that to an extent. It all depends on where you are within your constituency spending limits. Within your limits in each seat. And then the second question, I think, is, all the academic research suggests that paid people are less effective at this than your friends, your neighbours, all that jazz.
I'd also push back slightly on that point of, does Labour automatically have a defensive advantage in terms of its ground game in those seats? Because in any number of these seats, Labour has not had to defend them since forever. As a consequence, the infrastructure is not as strong as you might imagine it to be. What's more, with the Labour mindset going into this election that it was going to be an offensive rather than defensive campaign, the Labour Party hadn't been planning on deploying resource there and hadn't been organising in that fashion. As a consequence, Labour will still be playing catch-up to quite a significant extent in some of those defensive positions.
I think one of the fascinating things on that point is this so-called sophomore balance that MPs who were elected for the first time in 2017 benefit in 2019. I mean, you see that very clearly in the North East, right? Take Stockton and Darlington, Stockton South and Darlington, two Leave voting seats, right? On paper, Stockton South looks a lot easier for the Tories to pick up than Darlington. Stockton South has a Labour MP who was elected, local GP, who was elected at the last election. The YouGov, now, caveat alert, it has the Tories and Labour totally tied up in terms of vote share, but it has Labour winning the seat by the slimmest of margins. And it seems very weird that the Tories can win Darlington but not win Stockton South. And I think it is this effect that, you know, only six of those 28 seats that went from the Tories to Labour at the last election are coming back to the Tories this time around. Some of them, like Canterbury, are explained by the Remain factor. Others of them appear to be this incumbency advantage of new MPs. And then you see it on the Tory side, where Mansfield, which went Tory very narrowly last time round, now looks like a fairly comfortable double-digit Tory hold.
And there will be an unusual twists and turns on that. Like the MRP will find it more difficult, indeed problematic, to estimate what is going to happen, say, in East Devon, where there's a very local, very popular independent. The MRP will find it more difficult to predict what will happen in Finchley and Golders Green with the concentration of Jewish voters and Luciana Berger, the ex-Labour MP's candidacy there. So it is not to say that in each of these instances it's 100% accurate, and it's important to caveat accordingly.
Now, Marcus, you've already given us your now cast, but I'm going to put James on the spot and ask for his own prediction of what's going to happen tomorrow night.
So, throughout this campaign, I thought that the most likely result was a Tory majority somewhere between 20 and 50. I think we are clearly now operating at the lower end of that spectrum. I think it is a sign of where things are, that if you had Boris Johnson sitting where Marcus is and you offered him a majority of 8, I don't think you'd see your hand. But I think looking at the YouGov MRP, hearing what people are saying on the ground, I think that although there is obviously inherent uncertainty given how close so many seats are, I think we're probably looking at a Tory majority in the very low 20s. Now, on the one hand, that is obviously not as big as the MRP model suggested earlier in the campaign if the election had taken place a couple of weeks ago. But I think it is worth remembering that that would be larger than both the majority David Cameron won in 2015 and the majority that John Major won in 1992. And so while it would constrain Boris Johnson's freedom of action, given that MPs are younger, healthier and tend to live longer, I think this majority would last for 4 or 5 years. I don't think we would be heading back to the polls in an early election because the Tories couldn't govern. But you know, the big caveat I would add is these margins are so fine. And while as in 2017, Theresa May had a ready safety net in terms of those 10 DUP MPs, Boris Johnson does not have that. And so, you know, if he is below, you know, depending on how many seats Sinn Féin win, if he is below 323, it's very difficult to see how he could put together any kind of governing arrangement. One thing I would say to listeners, which I'd be intrigued to hear what Marcus is, I think we are anyone who thinks that they're going to be able to turn the TV on at 10 o'clock and go to bed at 10 past 10, knowing who they're going to wake up with in the morning,
as a result of the exit poll.
Yeah. Might well be in for disappointment, because I think it is very likely, given how many seats are close, that the exit poll does not come with a definitive prediction. It will predict which party is going to have the most seats, but I'm not sure whether it will predict definitively which result we're looking at, whether we're looking at a Tory majority or hung parliament. And obviously that matters, because the Tories have no potential partners in the event of a hung parliament.
Marcus?
Yeah, I would be looking at the exit poll tomorrow night to see how big their prediction is for what happens, because if it is very narrow result, then I think all of those caveats that James just raised about it will be operative. But I do believe that the exit poll is run by some of the very best.
I'm saying they might not call it.
Oh, then they might not.
Not that it will be wrong, but they might choose to wait until they've seen some results before they actually definitively say what is going to happen.
I'd be surprised. I think that they will make a call, and I think it will almost certainly be right. The question is it large enough for us to say with confidence at the beginning of the evening we now know the result, or if it's very narrow, then these very tight margins will really matter?
Well, so those who have been listening to this podcast to find out whether they have to stay up all night tomorrow night or not, sorry, you probably are going to have to. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the next podcast.